In my last lecture today, I'd like to talk a bit about the geometry that is behind the fundamental lemma. I'm only going to be able to begin a discussion of this topic, and today's my last lecture, so I want to give you some references, first of all, so that you can continue reading up on the subject after I finish. These are all papers on the archive. There are three papers by Lamont that I would recommend. The first is 97 with Rapoport. There's been a lot happening recently, and this one is already quite dated, but it's worth taking a close look at because a lot of the ideas grew out of this paper. And then I don't have the exact titles, but one is on Springer fibers, and another one was posted, I think, about December of last year. And of the three, I particularly recommend this one. It's in French. Lamont gave a lecture here in March, and that lecture has been posted up so that if you want to read the paper and follow the lecture along, it's a good way to get into the geometry. And then the other two papers I want to recommend are by Gresky, Kotwitz, and McPherson. I believe these were both posted last month. These papers deal with the geometry in general, but they don't go as far. These papers deal with the special case of the unitary group. And there are a lot of points of contact between these different papers, but this takes it farther in a special case. So yesterday, I gave a statement of the fundamental lemma. G is an unramified reductive group, and H is an unramified endoscopic group. As you'll recall, it's an identity between integrals on two different groups, and in both cases, the elements are indexed by a regular semi-simple element in the endoscopic group. To carry this out, we had to transfer the torus and this element over to an element inside G. And then this was some sort of sum over conjugates of stable conjugates of this element. We had a characteristic function of a hyperspecial. We took its orbital integrals, weighted by a kappa, which was a character on a cohomology group, and then there were certain normalizing factors, including something to keep the entire expression bounded. And then there was a similar identity on H, and the fundamental lemma is the conjecture. There's an equality of this form. For the statement of the fundamental lemma, it's not enough to know abstractly that a Cartan subgroup here is isomorphic over F to a Cartan subgroup over here, we really want to pin down exactly what that isomorphism is. And I wanted to work one example today at the beginning to show how you might pin down this particular matching. So I'll work here with the unitary group. I'd like to start working with the Lie algebra rather than the Lie group. I mentioned at the end of the lecture last time that there's a general reduction using the theory of homogeneity that reduces the general conjecture to the conjecture about something in the Lie algebra. Also, I gave, so the Lie algebra of G will just be the algebra of skew Hermitian matrices. And I gave an exercise at the end of the first lecture to check that the elliptic endoscopic groups for the unitary group were just a product of two smaller unitary groups. And I'm just going to look at the case of the elliptic endoscopic groups here. So I've got two constants, n1 plus n2 plus n, and this is the elliptic case. So if I call my element x now instead of gamma to indicate I'm working in the Lie algebra, let's pick, we have an unramified quadratic extension. Let's pick epsilon inside a group of units such that when I conjugate minus epsilon, X is going to be a skew Hermitian matrix in the Lie algebra, and X then divided by this element epsilon is Hermitian. I haven't said what Hermitian form I'm using, but let's say a word about that in a moment. And so I can take its characteristic polynomial over E, and the fact that it's Hermitian means that it's going to be a polynomial with coefficients in F, and I can get an extension element A, which is just the image of this polynomial. And this is a product of field extensions. That I get by factoring this polynomial into irreducibles. And so I get a collection of elements AI inside here. And I can tensor this. So to put the epsilon back in, I'm going to tensor back with E again. And this is going to contain the element A tensor epsilon. The Galois group acts on the second factor. And it negates this epsilon. And so what I get is an element inside this tensor product that is negated by the action of the Galois group. So X is a tensor epsilon. And if I write for any b in this tensor product, I'll write b star for the action on the second factor. I get that x a tensor epsilon star equals 0. So what I've done is I've started out with a Hermitian matrix. I want to pick out in the stable conjugacy class. So if I look in the group and take the stable conjugacy class, it's going to break up into a number of conjugacy classes inside the stable conjugacy class. And as it turns out, the stable conjugacy class is entirely determined by the characteristic polynomial. But I want to pick out, of all those things with a given characteristic polynomial, one that is best somehow. And that best one is going to be the choice that I use in the fundamental lemma. So what is the strategy? I start with any element x, and I want to abstract away and look at just its characteristic polynomial. So what I've done here is I've pulled the element x out of the unitary group and expressed it abstractly in terms of field extensions and an element that has this particular property inside this collection of field extensions. And now I'm going to put it back in a rather canonical way, and that's going to pick out the choice of conjugacy class within the stable conjugacy class. Okay, so there are two steps, pulling the element out, putting it back in. Yes? So the star is just sending an element. It's just the action on the second factor of conjugation. So it's what I call bar on the second factor. So star A tensor U is A tensor U. Okay, so we have pulled okay. Now we put it back in. That's going to fix our choice. So we want to, this is an element that we construct inside the group G. So what we take is an element gamma, and that's, well, yeah, so if we take, yeah, let me backtrack. Let's take y, z in this product. And then take the characteristic polynomial of this of the product of two characteristic polynomials. And call that px. So this is the matching between endoscopic group and the group G. So what we want to do is consider an element abstractly as sitting inside a product of field extensions, and we want to construct a vector space around it and a Hermitian form around it in such a way that this is a skew Hermitian matrix. for this Hermitian form. So construct a vector space. Once we have a vector space in a Hermitian form, then we've put it back in to a unitary group, and that will be our canonical choice of base point. Okay, so how is this done? We need a vector space. Well, this is a vector space. Okay, we need to construct using our element a vector space, and this is a vector space over E. So we forget about the original unitary group, the original vector space, and now we pretend that this element is, we concentrate on this one element, and so the vector space that we're going to use is F and PX. And the Hermitian form well, this is actually an algebra, and we can construct a bilinear form, a trace form, just use the trace form on this algebra to construct our Hermitian form. So if I take any alpha, then I can take a pairing x, y, alpha is trace alpha x, y, and make it Hermitian. I'll put a star in here. And now I have a, so this is, let me call this, give this a name, call this EI. EI over E. This gives me a Hermitian form. So the only question is, what element alpha do I want to use? And the question of picking out an element in the stable conjugacy class comes down to picking out which alpha I use to determine the Hermitian form. So which alpha is going to be best? Well, there's a algebra A that I get by taking the ring of integers and looking at the ring generated by taking different polynomials in this element X. This is the same X, yes, I'm looking at. Well, let me call it what I'm calling it. It's this element A, tensor E. Okay, this is a lattice. These Hermitian forms, I can take the perpendicular of A with respect to alpha, which will be the element X I such that So then the answer is to pick alpha. So that A is self-dual. That is, you pick alpha so that this equation holds, and that's what you use to pick out the good Hermitian form, to pick out the choice of a given conjugacy class within a stable conjugacy class. Now, I won't give the particular formula for how you make the trace form dual, but there are calculations in Serre's local fields that show when you have a field extension and you take the trace form, there's a calculation of what's called the differant, which is telling you how to achieve duality, self-duality, with the trace form. So explicit formulas here in Serre, local fields, and the factor in the fundamental lemma was calculated by Vols-Berger. And Lamont looked at that formula and noticed that it was just exactly the formula that appears in Serre. So this self-duality condition is exactly what goes into the definition of definition in the transfer factor. Yes. Yes. So this. It gives you it pins down the fundamental lemma, so there's no longer any ambiguity in what the statement of the fundamental lemma is. Yes. Yes. I mean we. Yes. Well, I mean, we're picking the canonical element in here. Yes. Yes. So we use that and construct a lattice using that, and we want that to be self-dual. Excuse me. So this is the transfer factor. And it's what I was calling kappa a tau, and this depended on a choice of element gamma zero, and this is then pinned down by this construction. Okay, so the original paper of Langlands and Schellstedt is rather technical. It would have taken several lectures to explain the choice had I used that construction, but this is a nice simplification. Okay, let's talk about the geometry. So let me start with an example, SL2. I'm calculating orbital integrals of the characteristic function of the hyperspecial maximal compact. And this condition reads G inverse gamma G is in K, or I can rewrite that as gamma G is in GK, or I can rewrite that again as gamma applied to the coset GK is equal to GK. And from this formula, we see that a solution here is giving a fixed point of the action of gamma on the coset space. So this is a fixed point. G of F. Okay. K is a hyperspecial maximal compact in SL2 here, and that is gives a point in the building. So in the case of SL2, the building is just a tree. There's an action of the group on the building, and what we have is a fixed point. And these other cosets as well can be identified with vertices in the building. You don't get all vertices this way because there are two conjugacy classes in the case of SL2 of vertices, so the group doesn't act transitively. But you get a set of points in the building, and then this equation is asking for fixed points in the building. So this integral is actually computing the number of fixed points of an element gamma acting on the building, where you just count one special kind of vertex. So the orbital integral counts number of vertices of a given type. Fixed in the building. Okay, and you can do that for the element gamma. You can do it for the element gamma prime at stable conjugate. And then you just calculate these numbers and add them together and do the same for the group H. And you check that the fundamental lemma holds. This gets combinatorially very difficult very quickly. So the only cases... So SL2 can be done this way. U3, unitary group and three variables, can be done this way. But some special cases in rank 2 situations have been done. I'm not aware of any rank 3 situation that's ever been attempted using the building, because the combinatorics of the fixed point sets gets too complicated. So this is what I call the 1970s, early 80s approach to computing fixed points. Things changed in 1988 with a paper by Kasdan and Lustig. They take G mod and interpret it. So this is now, for much of this geometric interpretation, people assume they're working in positive characteristics. So let's just take here our field to be one of positive characteristic for the rest of this lecture. What's that? Lamont's work is exclusively in positive characteristic. So in 1988, Kazhan and Lustig interpret this as an algebraic object. Well, it's a coset space, it's an algebraic object, but as an object in algebraic geometry, as an in scheme. So the idea, let me just illustrate it, for example, with GLN. G of F acts on lattices in F in n-dimensional vector space, and if I take the lattice O in F, its stabilizer is just GLN F, and this action is transitive, so I can identify this coset space with the set of lattices inside this vector space. So G F mod K as a G space can be identified sort of lattices. Then if I'm given lattices L0 and L1, this lattice is inside this lattice. Since this is over FQT, this is just going to be a vector space. And to give a lattice that's sandwiched between the two, is to give a subspace, a vector space, inside this vector space. And so the lattices that are sandwiched between two lattices can be thought of as a point in some appropriate Grassmannian of vector spaces inside a larger vector space. And then you need to vary the enclosing vector spaces and take limits to get the algebraic structure on G mod K. And so in the end, it's not going to be just a scheme, but an inductive limit of schemes. That's very rough, but this is what Kazhan and Lustig do. And in the end, this fixed point set is cutting out a scheme inside this big infinite dimensional N scheme. If you want details, this particular paper goes through this in quite careful detail in the case of the unitary group to see. Okay, let me set up a bit of a chart here comparing what happens analytically and what happens geometrically. So this column will contain the analytic information, or the arithmetic information here. This column will give the geometric interpretation. So in this chart, everything is in positive characteristic. I'll use the unitary Lie algebra, and H will be an elliptic Lie algebra of an elliptic endoscopic group. So instead of looking at cosets, as you do with a straightforward calculation of orbital integrals, in the geometric picture, you look at lattices. So just the straightforward lattice picture is what you get for the general linear group. When you pass to the unitary group, you're just going to get lattices with a special structure to them. And what you find is that you get lattices that are self-dual with respect to the Hermitian form. Instead of taking the condition defining the integral in the orbital integral, we take the fixed point set which I'll call x gamma in G of k. And through the work of Kashdan and Lustig, this can be thought of as the set of points of a scheme over the finite field. So when we integrate over the group G and reinterpret it in this picture, instead of getting just a fixed point set, we're now counting the number of fixed points. Now, in general, so as you recall, when we integrated, we did not integrate over all of G. We did not integrate over all of G for a good reason, and that is that the integral diverges. So we had to quotient out and divide over just by T of F, the centralizer in G of gamma. And so what does that correspond to in this geometric picture? Well, the centralizer can be written as a product of a compact piece, which doesn't affect the convergence of the integral. And lattice, so which does affect the convergence. Okay, so in this picture, I'm if I take CG gamma mod compact. This is a discrete group, and in fact a free abelian group. And what I do is I fix a splitting of this quotient back up into the group to write it as a product of this free abelian group times something that's compact. And how does this lack of convergence show up when I go over to the geometric interpretation? Well, what it means is that we get a scheme with infinitely many points. What we have is something might be locally finite, but a typical example of the type of scheme that you get might look something like this with infinitely many components. And if you try to count, you get an infinite number. But under this translation, it's clear why this is happening, and it's because we're not taking into account this torus. And what we find in the geometric picture is that there's a free action of this group ZL on this variety X gamma. So you can take a quotient and it's the fixed points on this quotient variety that you want to count. Okay, so if this, for instance, is something like this, if I take the action of Z identifying these different lines, I might get something like this as the quotient. And then the number of points on that is computing the orbital integral. Okay, what about the kappa that comes up in the description of the transfer factor? In the description of the orbital integral and the fundamental lemma. Well, in the unitary case, we take self-dual lattices in X gamma. But once I pass to the quotient, if I want to look at what the rational points are on this quotient variety, this is no longer just a lattice, but it's a lattice mod the action of this group. So I take a lattice L, the condition is self-duality. So I take its perp with respect to the Hermitian form defining the unitary realgebra. But in the quotient, the rationality condition becomes self-dual in the quotient, but that only needs to be up to some translate because those define the same point now in the quotient. And if I pick a different representative, a different lattice up here representing an element down here, what you find is that this element lambda is well defined up to a multiple of 2, and L And you should think of this quotient lattice as being the geometric analog of the Tait-Nakayama isomorphism that came up in the lecture yesterday. The Tait-Nakayama isomorphism is what allowed us to define the kappa in the statement of the fundamental lemma. And what you find is that H, which we think of as a product of two unitary groups here, this defines a partition into two pieces, and this data gives a partition of this set, this little abelian group, into a product of two abelian groups. So this isn't hard, but I'll skip the detailed explanation. And what you can take is kappa that takes each generator in the first piece to 1 and each generator in the second piece to -1. Is it clear what I mean here? So what this does is it breaks the set of fixed points in this variety up into two sets, a positive piece and a negative piece, and the kappa orbital integral corresponds to counting the number of points in the positive piece and subtracting off the number of points in the negative piece. And that is the geometric interpretation, then, of the kappa orbital integral. Okay, what about the interpretation of the final factor in the orbital integral? So this minus sign is the non-trivial. Why is this? So you're asking for a proof that this. So in general, the kappa is the root of unity. That gets assigned to the orbital integral. So kappa in the unitary case, yes. So with this exercise, the S was identified with something in here, and each coordinate was either a +1 or a -1. And if you group together the plus ones and the minus ones, you get the two different pieces of the root system of this product. Okay, so I need to count here, and I need to count here. And then there is this normalizing factor to keep things bounded. And on one side, the product was over all the roots of G, and on the other side of the equation, the product was over all the roots of H. So if I combine those two factors together, the difference between the two sides of the equation that I'm trying to prove equal will be the roots in G, but not in H. And this is just going to be some power of Q depending on the element gamma. So D Let me state first what the idea of Lamont-Rapoport was. So and that is, what this is saying is that if I count the number of points on one side of the equation and I count the points on the other side of the equation, the answer should be off by a factor of q to the d. Right? There should be exactly q to the d times more on one side. So this was the picture that there's somehow the z gamma plus, z gamma minus, and they want to identify this piece with a subset of the plus piece and subtract it away and then take what remains and map it down to the corresponding thing for the endoscopic group. So this is now the stable version. So I'll just write this as C stable H gamma. And you'd like the fiber under this map to have exactly Q to the D points. And that way you'd get an exact matching of the counts on both sides. So if you draw the picture this way, the natural guess is to think, well, maybe this is some sort of fiber bundle over this, and the fiber bundle is just with fiber an affine space of dimension d, and when you count, you get the number of points over the finite field raised to the d, and you've proved the fundamental lemma. So they were able to carry this out in a special case. This is okay if you go to a quadratic extension. But they were never able to carry out the strategy over the base. So if this isn't what they do, what do they actually do? Well, they take the ring generated by this element. This is in the ring of integers of the algebra that in the earlier example I called OEI, and they interpret, so this is interpreted geometrically as the completion the local ring of a curve. So let me give an example. If I take an element gamma to be just, say, T, the uniformizer here, minus T, its characteristic polynomial is, say, lambda squared minus T squared. So this is in the completion, but now if I look at the corresponding equation, not in the completion, but in a polynomial ring, what I get is a curve defined by T lambda mod this polynomial. And in this case, it's just if I plot the lambda and t, I just get two intersecting lines. Right, so you have to do the reverse process to find the curve, and then you complete again to go back to A. So lattices in this interpretation become, first of all, modules of this ring. To say that you have a fixed point, gamma. And then once you've constructed the curve, he uses this module description to produce torsion-free modules of this curve. He shows their generic. So I'm about out of time, so let me just say a few words, and then I'll leave it to you to read these papers. You've seen enough to this point to see how this analytic expression gets reinterpreted in terms of geometry. I knew it was hopeless to try to explain everything in the course of one lecture. In Paris, they're running a two-month seminar on all of this, being organized by Laforgue and attended by many of the top representation theory people, algebraic geometers, and so forth, understanding this work of Lamont and Gretzky, Kautz, and McPherson. It's a big project, but there's a lot of energy going into it right now. I'm convinced that Lamont has really found the underlying mechanism for what's going on in the fundamental lemma for the unitary group. What he does in the end, interpret the number of points here as the number of points on a compactification of the Jacobian of this curve. Okay, so you have a curve, it has a Jacobian, it's a singular curve, so you need to compactify it. You count the number of points on that object, and you're getting exactly the number of points computed by this orbital integral. And then to do the comparison of orbital integrals, you have a curve on one side, you have a curve on the other, you deform one of the curves so that it becomes, so you deform the curve on one side into the curve on the other, and it carries along these compactified Jacobians and the count and the number of points on the two sides, and you see that the fundamental lemma has to be true for very geometric reasons. Okay, so that in 2 minutes is what we should really devote 2 years to studying, but I hope that at least gives you the motivation to look into it more deeply.